Well, maybe they do, but not right now, because it's me, Seth, here for another week, for another show, for another 1001 songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Australian music journalist Toby Cresswell. Now, the first song which Mr. Cresswell has graced this the airwaves with its presence tonight is Mr. Tambourine Man, which of course was written and performed by Bob Dylan originally and featured on the 1965 album Bringing It All Back Home. But this version we've got here, the version that the cover version, in fact, that Mr. Cresswell has selected, which I believe only has one of Dylan's five verses. The one that Mr. Cresswell has selected here is the Mr. Tambourine Man by Bob Dylan, but it's covered here by The Byrds. That was The Byrds there, covering Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man. Now, in that track, they changed it from 2-4 time in Dylan's original to 4-4 time, which is basically a question of phrasing. If you phrase it in fours or in twos, you can essentially achieve the same effect if you halve the notes and double the speed, or vice versa. But anyway, you're listening to Waiheke Radio, 1001 songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. I'm Seth, and I am taking you through for the next hour. Now, next up, we've got Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles. Actually, I think this is the first Beatles track that... Mike's giving me problems. The first Beatles track that Mr. Cresswell has listed in here, which is, I think, very, really quite unusual, considering the effect, considering the effect and influence that Mr. Cresswell has had, not that the Beatles have had, on music over the past 100 years, which is essentially what the music is all, what this, this book is all about. See, he wasn't really trying to come up with the greatest songs of all time so much as the songs that have been influential over the course of music over the past 100 years. And he said himself that there is no canon, there is no best song that some of the songs are truly awful, but each of the song is relevant, and each of the song truly deserves a place in these 1001. I bet that, you know, he was just sitting there. He had 1002 all ready to go, but the editor says, no, you got to stop at 1001. He was probably gussied, you know, the way these musical editors are, well, music journalistic editors are. But anyway, Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles. Can't Buy Me Love was the first truly perfect marriage of rock music and celluloid. The song features in Richard Lester's film A Hard Day's Night as the Fab Four, having been cooped up in the straight world, suddenly burst out of the fire escape door and down the metal staircase to the sound of this chuff guitar riff ringing in their ears. Nothing before or since has expressed so well the liberating feeling of rock and roll. Paul McCartney wrote Can't Buy Me Love while on tour in France in January 1994, and it was cut in Paris. It was the only Beatles session to happen outside of London. Lester included it in the film after rejecting the first song written for the sequence. George Martin also played a big role in the song by suggesting that it begin with its chorus, giving it not only a hook, but also an extra momentum. The driving rock of the verses and then major key changes into the chorus are typical of how strong the Beatles were getting into with composition. The guitar solo by Harrison is as unbridled as the sequence to which it was synced. Hard Day's Night was the first all-Beatles written album and reflected their independence and pace with which they were growing. You can hear it all on this track. This track from 1964 appears on the album A Hard Day's Night. The Beatles, Can't Buy Me Love.
Can't buy me love.
Lots of momentum there in that track. That's Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles. You're listening to Waiheke Radio. And we broadcast here at Waiheke Radio on 88.3 FM and or 107.4 FM. Now, you can also, if you're not on the island or you don't have a radio or you're in some sort of other tricky situation, you can pick us up on waihikiradio.org.nz/listen, wherein we do a live streaming, which is very live and very streamlined. Now, what is it? Next track. That's the thing we do now, is next track. It's usually about this time that I forget myself and go on for some rambling tour of Well, you know, not unlike what I'm doing now, really, but longer. The next song, however, is from 1970, Joni Mitchell and Circle Game. Joni Mitchell was born Roberta Joan Anderson on the 7th day of November in 1943 in the province of Alberta in Canada. Very big on skiing there, I think. Or moose. Or mountain biking. Ice hockey. Or something like that. Anyway, in Alberta in Canada. It's, you know, I can't remember. There's something significant about Alberta. She was inspired to be a graphic artist and painter that was drawn into the Canadian folk scene. It was a milieu that she met another Canadian singer-songwriter, Neil Young. They met in 1964 at the Fourth Dimension Folk Club. Oh, I'm really, really getting very good at enunciating tonight, aren't I? At the University of Manitoba. And she encountered him again at the Yorkville District of Toronto in 1965. It was likely that the latter venue was that Mitchell first heard Neil Young's Sugar Mountain, which he had written on his 19th birthday, regressing the loss of his youth. Poor guy. Mitchell wrote Circle Game in response. So the years spin by, the child is nearly 20. Though his dreams are lost, some grandeur coming through. I'm not quite sure how the phrasing goes on this. But what he goes on to say, though, is that the song, full of compassion and wisdom and generosity, is remarkable for the 21-year-old as Mitchell there was. In reply, Neil Young wrote Sweet Joni from Saskatoon for her. When she moved to Los Angeles, Young introduced her to his circle of friends, the leading tastemakers and power brokers in music at the time. Circle Game was first recorded by folk duo Ian and Sylvia in 1966 with Clouds. It was one of her first hit songs. I realize now that in songs like Circle Game and Big Yellow Taxi have almost become nursery rhymes. They've become part of the culture. Mitchell said recently, I didn't write Circle Game as a children's song, but I'm very pleased to see that it's gotten to the culture that way. Joni Mitchell, ladies and gentlemen, with Circle Game.
Gone now. town. And they tell him, take your time, it won't be long now, till you drag your feet too slow, the circle's down. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came, and go round and round and round in the circle.
Circle Game by Joni Mitchell. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 FM, 107.4 FM. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by one Australian music journalist, Mr. Toby Cresswell. Mack the Knife by Bobby Darin. Well, not actually by Bobby Darin. It's performed in this particular recording by Bobby Darin, but it was actually written by a German fellow by the name of Kurt Weill. There's lyrics as well by Bertolt Brecht. Bertolt Brecht wrote the original German lyrics. This song is from the Threepenny Opera, by the way. You know, Bertolt Brecht, theatrical philosopher and everything. You know, it's something that's what they teach in school drama now. It's all crap, really. But anyway, Bertolt Brecht came up with the original lyrics, and then they were translated by one Mark Blitzen into English. Now, this particular version was recorded for Atlantic Records in 1959 by Bobby Darin. Another murder ballad that topped the charts was Mack the Knife. It introduces the character of McHeath in Brecht and Weill's The Threepenny Opera. Given that Brecht was an outspoken communist, it's somewhat surprising that the Threepenny Opera should have met with such a warm reception on Broadway. Even more surprising was that in the 50s, the sound would be reviewed with a swing arrangement by Louis Armstrong and shortly thereafter by Bobby Darin. Walden Robert Cassotto, a.k.a. Bobby Darin, was an accomplished and sophisticated songwriter who'd been successful as a teen idol. Elmet Ertgun, the urbane co-president of Atlantic, had an instructive touch and teamed Darin up with Mack the Knife, taking him out of the pop world and into a more adult sphere. Jazz and blues records weren't going to pay the rent, said engineer-producer Tom Dowd, so they wanted to find something that was more in the tradition that they had enjoyed doing. They used people that they had revered and idolized for so long that they could exploit because it had some value in early days in New York. No one was out looking for the Atlantic Records. It was a label they wanted to be on. They'd rather go to RCA or Columbia. so Atlantic was always the lookout for new and innovative artists who could preserve the blues and jazz tradition, but the company was concerned that the songs should be timely and would cater to the root of the artist, and at the same time would be merchandisable. Mack the Knife made number one. It was the first non-R&B pop hit to for Atlantic and helped establish the label's future. Brecht would have appreciated the irony of his bloodthirsty song being sung by so many sophisticated bourgeois bachelors. That's Bertolt Brecht, ladies and gentlemen, who wrote the lyrics for Mack the Knife, performed here by Bobby Darin.
Who the shark be has such teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie, and it keeps it out of sight. You know that shark bites with his teeth, dear. Scarlet billows start to spread. What fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie, babe. So there's never, ever a trace of red. Someone's sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mack the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is for ten old Mackies back in town. Now he came by Louis Miller. He disappeared, babe, after drawing out all of his harder cash. And now Maggie's been just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done Southern Ranch? Oh, in his diver, yeah.
The Ballad of Mack the Knife, or originally, and I'm going to get this wrong, Die Mordtat von Mackie Messer, or something like that. Anyway, it's German, and it means The Ballad of Mack the Knife. Of course, the lyrics for Die Mordtat von, don't ask me to say it again, Die Mordtat von Mackie Messer were by Bertolt Brecht, the theatrical philosopher there, who wrote the lyrics and book for the Threepenny Opera, and of course the English version translated by Mark Blitzen. Now, the music for the Threepenny Opera was written by Kurt Weill. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, Which, actually, that shouldn't be part of the same sentence as the other three last items there, but you do actually happen to be listening to Waiheke Radio wherever that actually occurs in a sentence. The other little fun fact about Waiheke Radio I have for you is that we actually broadcast here on Waiheke Radio. We broadcast on 88.3 FM or 107.4 FM. Or actually, I've got this big sign up here this evening that says we do it on the net as well, which is www.waihikiradio.org.nz/listen. The Stones, the Rolling Stones, and Come On from 1963, the Rolling Stones had were the second cab off the rank. Once the Beatles had broken through, it was apparent that there was a surge of interest in this beat music. The Beatles were essentially a pop band from the north. The Rolling Stones were a blues band from the south, and clearly cooler as a proposition. Bit of a tongue twister there. The Rolling Stones manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, was a wonderful marketeer who understood sex appeal and the attraction of the dark side. Unlike the Beatles, the Rolling Stones did not write their own material. Rather, they refashioned American blues and R&B. For their first single, Oldham chose Come On, an obscure Chuck Berry song. It was middle ground, guitarist Keith Richards recalled. It was also very pop. We threw in a couple of Bo Diddley songs, and I think it was chosen because it was so obviously more chart-oriented. Recorded in one take, Come On has the urgency of the best Stones material. There's a frustration and a speedy anxiety, as though life was passing by at breakneck pace. One track did it, Richards recalls, and then suddenly he's sitting there in that terrible jacket on top of the pops and going, "This isn't the version I had." The Rolling Stones, ladies and gentlemen, and Come On here on Waiheke Radio.
Somebody come along and run into it and wreck it. Everything is wrong. I've been to bathroom every night I leave. They get the bathroom every time I phone. Sounds like thunder. Some stupid guy trying to reach another number. Come on. Since I've been with Batch, come on. Always thinking about you, come on. Phone sounds like thunder. Some stupid guy trying to reach another number. Trying to make you see that I belong to you, and you belong to me, and come on. I gotta see you, baby, come on. I don't mean maybe, come on. I gotta make you see that I belong to you, and you belong to me, and come on.
Hailing there from the days of 1963, the Rolling Stones, and Come On! You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4. And this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. And, oh, we've got Madonna next. I don't know if any of you Madonna really appeals to you, but I think most people have probably heard this song. It's Like a Virgin. Yeah, what does Mr. Cresswell have to say about that? Well, I'd give it that it's certainly influential on the past 100 years of music. In fact, I should just be generally more positive towards it. The track told the world that Madonna was not just here to mince words. It's about sex. The startling thing was how untroubled Madonna seemed to be about the whole affair. She took what could have been a torch song and just played with it. And the production and the beats are light and airy and tossed off in a flirting style, working with a cheek producer, Nile Rodgers, the record had a masterful pop sheen and an innate sense of where the beat lay. It's mostly its attitude that put Madonna into a class of her own. She was an icon of a generation that emancipated women. She sexualized everything. That boy toy buckle was pure irony, and in taking control of her sexuality, Madonna was the leader of the next wave of emancipation. Like a Virgin was as controversial as the Christian right trying to keep it from the airwaves. Nonetheless, it was Madonna's first number one single. I mean, there's a lot of really narrow-minded people, she told MTV Europe. I really can't predict how far-reaching they can be and how many people I can change and how my tolerance will grow of the messages I put in my music. Dennis Wilson in Riversong from 1977 appears on Pacific Ocean Blue. Dennis Wilson passed through New York last week. I've got to do a voice. Dennis Wilson passed through New York last week to spread the word that the Beach Boys are no longer going to rely on their golden oldies to maintain the current status as a major concert attraction in the U.S. A newspaper report from 1976. I wonder if that newspaper was actually from New York. Need to work on my New York accent, really, don't I? Yeah. Dennis Wilton, who was the youngest Beach Boy, he was the drummer and the heartthrob, and the only actual surfer in the Beach Boys. He may have wanted to move on, but rock and roll's favourite dysfunctional family were never going to get past their many epics of the beach. Wilson, however, they're all Wilsons. How are we supposed to know which one? I take it Dennis Wilson, because this is who the song's by, Dennis Wilson and River Song, which I'm going to play for you in just a moment. So be patient! I know you've sat through the weather and Madonna and everything, but be patient. Wilson, however, was already writing the last great album of Beach Boys-related songs. Despite having named the Beach Boys 15 or so years before, Dennis was the least respected musician in the group. The lead vocals usually went to Mike Love or Carl Wilson, and, of course, Brother Brian was the resident genius who was as likely to make their album, doing all the parts himself. In the mid-70s, the Beach Boys were a nostalgia act, unable to make a listenable record. The fashions in the group were satisfied with the money from the road, and they saw themselves as a pop band. Dennis Wilson's solo work was somewhat more sophisticated and album-oriented. Despite inspiration, my mistake there, the group nestled under the wing of James William Guerrico, in the man behind the pop jazz phenomenon Chicago. Meanwhile, the songwriter Steve Carl... They really do have hard names to pronounce around here. Anyway, Wilson put together his first solo album in a culmination of these different people, suffice it to say. Pacific Ocean Blue begins with River Song, a magnificent piece of pop gospel that features double rock bass Baptist choir. On River Song, Wilson approaches the watery spirituality of the Beach Boys, but in a context that could be made sense of. Wilson binged his way through these sessions as he did his life. For all that, though, there is a sense of raw talent breaking through. As it turns out with the Beach Boys, everything always goes back to the summer fun hits, and Dennis Wilson, like his brother Brian, never did realize his full potential. Although there's certainly a great record here. Dennis Wilson and River Song. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4. I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. Dirge is next by Bob Dylan, which appears on his album from 1974 called Planet Waves. The lyrics start off with weak lines, and with just Dylan playing piano and Robbie Robertson on guitar. Dirge is searing thing. I'm not sure what that word is. V-I-T-I-R-O something. Anyway, it's a word, and it means something's quite strong, I think. And as self-loathing, fear and hatred and shame all come to fore by turns. Well, I mean something quite potent, you know, not necessarily strong, but, you know, poisonous-ish. For the past 3 years, Bob Dylan had written love songs to his wife. Indeed, some of the same sessions he cut Dirge, there was Wedding Song, which was a clear statement of devotion as you could find. Dirge seems to come from some other place. The way the perspective moves around the bitterness of the lyric is a pointer to the songs on Blood on the Tracks. The turmoil that descended on Dylan in the 70s was just beginning when he entered the solo, when he entered the studio to record Planet Waves. Dylan agreed his first major concert tour in almost 8 years, going out with the band as backing group and support act. It was the biggest rock and roll tour undertaken in that time. Dylan's contract with Columbia Records had expired after a decade, and he sighed and said with David Geffen's Asylum, things were not as smooth as they seemed. Dirge was the shape of things to come. Producer Rob Fraboni recalled that a version of the song had been cut early in the session for the album, and they were mixing the record. All of a sudden, he came in and said, I'd like to try Dirge on the piano. Fraboni recalled, we had recorded an earlier version with only an acoustic guitar and a few vocals a few days later. And we put on a tape, and he said to Robbie, maybe you could play guitar on this. And they did it once, and Bar playing piano and singing, and Robbie playing acoustic guitar. Second time was the take. That's Bob Dylan and Dirge.
That it showed. You were just a painted face on a trip down Suicide Road. The stage was set, the lights went out all around the old hotel. I hate myself for loving you, and I'm glad the curtain. We'll be right back.
showed me nothing yet. I paid the price of solitude, but at least I'm out of
Bob Dylan and Dirge. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as presented by yours truly, Seth Titley Jones, and selected by Australian music journalist Toby Cresswell. Now, speaking of Mr. Cresswell, now I remember he used that word that I couldn't pronounce, vitriolic, and so I've looked it up for your benefit, and it's actually sulfuric acid H2SO4. Actually, they've got down here H2O4S. Not sure why, but I've always known it H2SO4, and vitriolic means it's sulfuric acid, because the another name for sulfuric acid is the oil of vitriol. Anyway, it's very potent and poisonous, and it corrodes most things when it is concentrated. So you learn things here on Waiheke Radio. Anyway, enough of the chemistry. We've got another song. Actually, we do. Well, I think we do have time for one more song. And the song is I Am Woman, which is performed by Helen Reddy and appears on I Am Woman. And it was written by Helen Reddy and Ray Burton, which was, Toby Cresswell goes on about, that Australian singer Helen Reddy became one hit in the US with I Don't Know How to Love Him, but was struggling to establish herself when she came up with an anthem for the burgeoning women's movement. The phrase, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, has since become part of parlance. I wanted to write... Oh, no, she's Australian, isn't she? Oh, I wanted to write songs that reflected on the positive sense of self that I had gotten from the women's movement, she said. I thought about the women in my family and how strong they were, how during the world wars and depressions they had pretty much useless husbands and they had been glue that held the family together. I wanted a song that reflected that. It was my idea of womanhood. I realised that I was going to have to write it myself. I'd never thought about being a songwriter. I was lying in bed one night and the phrase, I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman, kept going over and over in my head, but I wasn't sure what invincible Invincible Mint, but it sounded like the beginning of something. Well, I had the lyrics, and I was trying to write music to go with them, but I needed someone to come in. The Executives was an Australian pop group I used to hang out with, and they used to play water polo and stuff. I asked one of the guys in the band, Ray Burton, if he could take a shot at it. It was on my first album, and I was mentioned in reviews, but it never got any airplay. And then the women's movement became more and more popular as producer at Columbia decided to make the film and to exploit what they thought was a hula hoop fad, the fad of women's lib. They put a script together out of Robin Morgan's book Sisterhood is Powerful, which is a series of anecdotes. They wanted to use Iron Woman under the opening credits, the Virgin, that was on my third album, and also that version became a hit. It was somewhat ironic that Reddy enlisted a man to co-write the song. Helen used to have a dozen of her girlfriends, sometimes up on a Sunday, and no guys allowed, Burton recalled. I was allowed up there a couple of times, but when I was, one guy with a dozen girls, and they're all whinging about their husbands and their boyfriends, and I went home, and they went home, and I'm still there with Helen and having a wine, and I said, if you're really serious about this, why don't you write some words down, and I'll take it away and make a song out of it. And that's basically what happened. She wrote it out on a piece of paper, and the next day I took them home and I worked on it. And then I Am Woman evolved from it. I find it very disheartening that Helen never mentioned my name in any of the interviews. I Am Woman is in my legacy, said Reddy. I have so many women to this day who will come up to me in public and say, your song gave me the courage to get out of that abusive relationship, or it's because of your song that I went to law school, or things like that.
Yeah.
Helen Reddy and I Am Woman, written by Helen Reddy and Ray Burton. And Toby Cresswell was musing on about how ironic it was that Helen Reddy got a man to co-write her song. But actually, and little fun fact about Ray Burton, he was in the band The Executives, which I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the TV series from the 70s, The Young Doctors. And the theme tune for that was played by The Executives, so the co-writer of this song actually played on that particular theme tune. Bit of a trivia fact for you there. Before I say goodnight to you for another week, this has been 1001 Songs with me, Seth, and selected. The songs, of course, were selected by Toby Cresswell. I'll give him that. I'll be back, as usual, next week, the same time, the same channel, Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM from 8 till 9 p.m.